Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why a new exhibit includes both artists and hairstylists and a sculptor's bond with his subjects. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Arizona law is clear on this point. No company has the right to endanger an entire community's health and safety for its own gain.
Now, 2 years later, executions in Arizona can still not be carried out humanely, yet the governor nonetheless is doing a 180 and is now vowing to once again carry out executions in the state.
He said that tumors had nothing to worry about, that he supported that recipient, and then rescinded the DACA program, and then said that he had a deal made with the Democrats and Republicans, and then all that fell through.
They don't want to see the chaos at the border. You know, we have a broken immigration system, but they are not asking for separations of family. They're not asking for us to get end birthright citizenship.
It was a close race, good candidates across the field, and, you know, I've got my Republican counterpart, and that's just how it goes sometimes. It could have easily been me on the other side of that.
And joining me to talk about Kerry Lake's new job in the Trump administration, AG Chris Mays' new lawsuit, and more are Marcus Dellertino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Matt Grodsky of Matters of State Strategies. Matt, good morning to you.
Morning.
So, Marcus, let me start with you and Kerry Lake being named the director of Voice of America under the Trump administration. There had been some talk that maybe she would be ambassador to Mexico, which would require Senate confirmation. This new role does not. What are your thoughts on this?
I suspect that this will not be her last job in the Trump administration. This appointment's a bit strange in the fact that her boss is not appointed yet and hasn't even been named. Trump said, you know, I will do it shortly. Okay, but that person needs to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Last time Trump was in office, that took about 2 years to get that person appointed. So there's a huge timeline drag here. And in the meantime, this organization has set up a new governing structure within itself, which allows a board to fire that executive director, not the president, but the board. I just have a sneaking suspicion that she might not be there that long, that we might have a future position in the Trump administration shortly.
Do you think that she would be moving on from that to something else within the administration?
I do. I think it's going to take a lot longer than people think to get everything settled out. And there's 1,000 more opportunities of places that she could enter the administration.
Now, what do you think?
I absolutely agree with that. It does feel a little clickbaity to me. And I do think the thing that Democrats and the larger population across the electorate need to remember is Trump's strategy from the first term through the election to now has always been to flood the zone with different things to distract us, right? And I feel like this is right out of that playbook. So I think we would be wise to not try to take the bait every time and get hung up on the new shiny object, because I do think it's part of a broader strategy to kind of exhaust people, right, before we even get to January 20th, and also take away some of the heat from some of the other folks that are trying to get, you know, appointed.
So by appointing someone like Kerry Lake, who is in many ways for a lot of people very controversial, maybe take some of the attention away from, for example, the Department of Defense nominee or the Director of National Intelligence nominee and put them on someone like Kerry Lake?
I think so. I think it's all part of that strategy to, oh, look over here so that you forget to be upset about this, and then you feel overwhelmed, and then that's exactly where he likes everybody.
So, Marcus, I don't want to, like, go too far down this rabbit hole, but if Kerry Lake ends up with a different job in the Trump administration at some point, better job than head of VOA or something more low profile, do you think?
Oh, I can't name the exact job.
Sure.
But I think it will be something that could move a little bit faster than this job, and probably a better paycheck. But to Matt's point, I would also say that there's a story out this morning or last night that basically says, look, Matt Gaetz was the throw-up nominee so we could get Hogsworth through DOD. And so, you know, that is part of the strategy. There's no doubt.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about and stipulate before we start this that none of the three of us in this room are lawyers. But
Thank God.
I'll leave that there. saying that Attorney General Chris Mayes, who is, of course, an attorney, sued the Saudi company Fondamente this week. She's been sort of telegraphing that this move was coming for quite a while. This is a company that has an operation in La Paz County in western Arizona. They grow alfalfa, send it back to Saudi Arabia for their cows to eat. The Attorney General, Matt, is using kind of an interesting strategy here. She acknowledges it's not really been tested to use this way, these nuisance laws, to try to stop the groundwater pumping here. I want to ask about sort of the politics of all of this, because, you know, water for the longest time, you guys both know this, was seen as sort of a bipartisan issue in Arizona. Recently, it's maybe become a little bit less so, especially on the state level, with the legislature not really being able to come to agreement between Democrats and Republicans, urban and rural lawmakers, on what to do about this. How is this going to play at the Capitol, do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen how it's going to play at the Capitol. But I think for Mays in particular, it's a great political win. I mean, she ran on this back in 2022. She's obviously taken action on it, still obviously continuing to do that. I think, and what I've seen on the ground talking with not just Democrats, but independents and Republicans, is beyond the legislature, the issue of water transcends politics, right? I mean, you've got people in agriculture that are stressed about it. People in metro areas are worried about, you know, what is it going to look like 10, 20 years from now? And the very simple concept of foreign company taking our water resources and essentially shipping it overseas, for lack of a better explanation, that resonates with people. So I think from a political perspective, it's a good thing for the AG to keep up.
Marcus, what do you think?
I think Chris had a banner week, probably maybe one of her best since she's been in office, one with this announcement. I mean, honestly, how are you going to lose on this one? You're opposing a foreign, richer than rich government who's taking our water, and then the asset that they're getting from that water, they're shipping overseas. I mean, come on. So that was her first win. And then the one that's really undervalued, I think, that I'm hearing from more and more people is the merger, the
Kroger,
proposed
Albertsons.
Merger of Kroger and Albertsons.
Which was blocked this week by
which
a
was
judge.
Blocked this week, and Chris was passionate about that issue. I'm with her on it, frankly, as the one who has to go do the most grocery shopping in my house. But the only person who was louder about it than me was my mother. My God. And so she was, it was a great week for her.
Well, so let me ask you this then. Does this help Chris Mayes win over people like your mom?
Oh, you know, we don't even have a nominee on the Republican side yet.
Sure.
So God only knows how that goes. But I will tell you, my mom now knows who Chris Mayes is.
Okay. As opposed to before.
I know you'll find this shocking, but not everybody in my family is glued to the political section of the newspaper. But
good for them.
But she's, I think she was excited. But oddly enough, she was more excited about the anti-Kroger Albertsons decision than water. But both were big wins for her politically. And I think Republicans should sort of tune into on the water side, particularly moving into this session.
Well, so Matt, Marcus said, you know, who's going to oppose going after a very wealthy foreign government, taking water here and shipping the assets overseas. But we saw earlier this year, there are some Republican lawmakers who tried to put in a bill that the governor vetoed to stop Mays from using nuisance lawsuits, understanding that this was at least one of the companies she was going to go after. So presumably it's not all sunshine and lollipops for
her. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, logically, you'd think no one would oppose that. But I think folks in the legislature on the Republican side tend to bank on average voter not getting that information, not knowing that part of the story. So I would argue it's incumbent on Democrats as a party, as a messaging apparatus. Obviously, the Mays campaign, once that gets up and going, to tell that story, right? Because it defies common sense, and that will resonate with people across the political spectrum. And I don't know Marcus's mom. She sounds wonderful. But I imagine more voters like that, who maybe weren't familiar with it to begin with, will tune in and see, okay, you know, that seems like a logical step. Why would anyone get in the way of that?
In the category of putting the cart miles and miles before the horse here.
Sure.
Let me just ask about the next election. Why not? I mean, there are people already saying they're running for stuff. Chris Mayes has said that she's going to run for AG again. There's been speculation maybe she would run for governor or something else. Does this, something like this, Matt, help her, especially with more rural voters, in terms of maybe not just the groundwater issue, but maybe, as Marcus brought up, the grocery merger as well?
Yeah, well, first off, I think everyone in the executive is going to be running for reelect in their positions. But yeah, I think it absolutely does. Remember, she's from a rural community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if there's anything that Democrats need to take from this past cycle is that we need to talk more with folks in rural counties across the state. So I think this story definitely resonates.
Marcus, do you think this helps Chris Mayes in places where Democrats have been struggling?
Yeah, I think, and Chris is probably doing the most out of it out of any Democratic candidate out there. But if you noticed her town halls in La Paz County, particularly packed, absolutely packed. And that's not exactly known as a liberal bastion. and then when she also did town halls, and this was a smart move, strategy, on the merger of Safeway and Fry's, and those town halls were packed. And they weren't just packed by Democrats. So she's using these issues strategically to her advantage.
So in terms of, like, if you are Chris Mayes, and I don't think anybody's suggesting she doesn't actually believe in these issues, that she's, you know, she wasn't using the merger, for example, as a political issue. I think she really believed
right.
that she's talked about this groundwater issue from when she was running for AG in the first place. But again, like, we're a long way out from another election, and these, you know, water is one of those issues that everybody talks about being important, but in terms of how you vote, not usually in the top few issue areas of how people decide to vote. Is there work to do to sort of tie these together to make it salient to voters in, you know, a year and a half?
Yeah, I absolutely think there is. I mean, you use those town halls and that energy to sort of build support so you can pivot into other issues. I don't think that the landscape is going to change too dramatically over the next 2 years. I think illegal immigration will continue to be the number one issue in the country. I think inflation in the economy will continue to be the number two, three issue in the country. And so you're going to have to pivot on that. And then, you know, the rumor, and I will just say it's the rumor, is that one of the Republican nominees for AG would be the current Senate President Warren Peterson. And he's definitely got experience in home building and development, and that comes with water experience, too. So there'll be a counterpoint on that. But they're also for the next 2 years at the legislature, sort of a battle of the heads. If the AG is going to try and pass something, you know, it's going to be difficult, I would say, through the Senate.
Matt, do you think that this lawsuit makes it more difficult, less difficult, no difference in difficulty in terms of trying to get big water stuff done at the legislature next year?
It depends on what the legislature wants to do in terms of if they want to either throw a wrench in that or if they actually want to cooperate. But I think regardless of what they decide to do, I think that to Marcus's point, you know, a lot of these issues are still going to be top of mind, you know, 2 years from now. And unfortunately, water is still going to be a problem for us at that stage. So I think tying this all together in a package for a reelect and talking about what we need to focus on long term, I think that's something that the party and the AG can focus on in their messaging.
All right. That is Matt Grodsky. I'm also joined by Marcus Dellartino. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week, Matt Grodsky of Matters of State Strategies and Marcus Dellartino of First Strategic. Guys, let's start this segment with news from the Arizona Republic. They reported about the attendance records of Arizona's outgoing senior senator, Kirsten Sinema. She's apparently missed a lot of votes, Matt, as her term has come to an end. Or is coming to an end.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of my senior year of high school. I think she's got a case of senioritis there. You know, she's just moving on to the next thing. You know, don't need to show up for these votes anymore. I don't know. It's very interesting. But, you know, I think she kind of saw the writing on the wall, obviously, over a year ago, which is why she switched parties, obviously didn't seek reelection. So I imagine she's kind of mentally on to the next thing at this stage.
Marcus, is this surprising? Is this sort of a case of senioritis?
It's, you know, first of all, let's be clear. There's no critical bills happening in the U.S. Senate right now. Like, it's not going to be the end of the earth, number one. Number two is her vote isn't going to be the deciding vote on any particular issue. But I am constantly amazed at the following of Kirsten Sinema, especially by the Arizona Republic, who's just not going to be happy until they beat her to a pulp. and also within the Democratic base. I mean, it's just never let her go. Let's just keep pounding on her. You know, look, she lost an election. She's entitled to take some time off. Again, her vote is not going to be the deciding vote on any of these things. Why are we still fascinated with whether she's going up for votes or not? Why don't we focus on what's coming down the pike? How is Rubin organizing? How is his office coming along? Is he ready to, you know, what's going to be his first piece of major legislation?
Is it, I wonder, though, is it kind of a bad look for a senator who makes a pretty decent salary to, you know, to basically not be showing up to vote? Or does that maybe not, as you point out, maybe it doesn't matter that much?
I'd be more concerned if her constituent services weren't getting done. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. And I would tell you that she probably has the best constituent service operation in the delegation right now. And so if you need a passport, you're calling her. If you need your Social Security check is late, whatever that federal interaction happens to be, all that stuff is continuing to happen. So, look, I'm not losing sleep over it. I'll tell you that much.
Okay. So, Matt, Marcus referenced how the Democratic base has, you know, kind of enjoyed taking some shots at Senator Sinema over the last couple of years. Is this just kind of an example of that? I mean, does it matter that she's not actually voting on these
things? Yeah, well, it brings up a good point that, you know, there's nothing absolutely critical at this stage. I do know that there's still a sentiment across the board in the party that they kind of felt betrayed and let down by some of the decisions that she made. Now, at the end of the day, yes, constituent services, that is where the rubber meets the road. You know, I don't think any of that has stalled to any degree. I also am not convinced that voters necessarily care much right now in December, a couple weeks before the holidays ramp up. But I just think it's an interesting decision to make in terms of legacy, how you'd want to end things, because she has taken it seriously, and she obviously has been passionate about her role there. So it's interesting, I think, is the way I would characterize
it. The irony
that.
Is, I mean, Joe Biden should be like going somewhere with her. I mean, he owes every success in his presidency to Kirsten Sinema. And I just find it laughable that none of the Democrats want to celebrate that success that she's solely responsible for, did the groundwork on. But we're going to have the Arizona Republic, you know, pound on her one last time. So anyway, sorry, I'm on my soapbox.
Do you think there's any chance that President Biden and Senator Sinema are like traveling together at all?
Oh God, no! He's not traveling.
That seems like an unlikely traveling duo at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if you notice the close of before he got out of the race, you know, there was a lot of visits to states, swing states on the East Coast, but getting him to come out to Arizona was somewhat of a chore because it's a longer flight, and I think that should give you sort of an inclination of where the president is right now.
All right. So, guys, we have the five finalists for the new Supreme Court justice. And again, stipulating none of us are lawyers. I want to ask, though, Matt, like, what do you think that Governor Hobbs will be and maybe should be looking for? We obviously, you know, it's been narrowed down from, I think it was like 18 or something was the original number of people who applied. It's sort of slowly been narrowed down. We now have the five finalists. What do you think the governor should be looking for when she speaks with these individuals?
Well, it's an interesting thing because these aren't, you know, the way most people think about Supreme Court things is at the national level, right?
Yep.
Where these are lifetime appointments. That's not the case here. You know, we have a unique situation.
And they don't have to be confirmed by the Senate.
Correct. And we haven't had a situation where a Democratic governor has been able to do something like this since, I believe it's 2005. So I think what she'll be looking for is a way to kind of cement a legacy as much as she can, given the way that the elections work for these positions. So I imagine that of the choices, you know, these individuals are going to be a Democrat or have Democratic leaning tendencies that will be sympathetic to more of our views. It's not going to change the makeup to any degree, but I think that's what she's looking for.
Do you think that the way that she's approaching this changes at all, knowing that the two justices who are on the ballot up for retention are staying on the bench?
I don't think so necessarily. I mean, I think they've gone about this in a very methodical way. You know, they're not giving any hints one way or the other. So I don't think it changes it too much. But I just do think that she's looking for, okay, what is this going to do long term, you know, past the time when I'm governor, right? And I think that's the main focus.
Marcus, what do you think the governor maybe can and maybe should be looking for?
Somebody who can interpret the law fairly. I mean, that's the job. And it shouldn't be that hard, but occasionally it is. You know, if you go back over those two judges who you just mentioned who were up for retention, the controversy surrounding them, which I didn't think was a controversy, but was that they interpreted a state law correctly, by the way, that the legislature had written to send us back to the territorial days interpretation of law on the abortion, right? And so the Democrats were angry with those two and wanted to vote them out, if you will. And that, of course, didn't happen. But what they did was interpret – if you wanted to be angry with somebody in that, you had to be angry with the legislature because they wrote the law. They interpret the law, and they interpreted it, fairly, I think. So you're looking for somebody who can actually interpret the law fairly, number one. Number two is I'm sure she's going to look for somebody who's got some likeness in her policy decisions, whether it's water or pro-choice, education, ESAs, that type of thing. But I will tell you, it should be difficult because all you're doing is interpreting the law. It should be difficult to make a counter conclusion that is absolutely opposite of what was written on the paper.
How much do any of you think age comes into this? Because to Matt's point, it's not a lifetime appointment. There is a mandatory retirement age. But if you pick somebody who is, let's say, a decade or two closer to that retirement age, that seems like if you're Governor Hobbs, that's a disadvantage.
I think that's an accurate way to look at that. I also think, not a lawyer, but the interpretation of these things, I think there is a generational component to some of these issues, right? And I do think that there's a benefit to an individual that is a little bit younger, right, who kind of sees things through a different lens than someone who might be a couple decades older. So I think that's something they might be considering, but that's certainly how I would look at it if I was making the decision.
Marcus, do you think age and years that somebody could serve on the court plays into this?
Much more down the line. I do think that more likely than not, it'll probably be a woman. I'm just spitballing and taking a wild guess. But I think when you get down to that sort of that level of detail, how long they can serve is probably less down there in qualifications. You're going to be wondering what kind of job they can do, most importantly.
Does this in any way become, I don't want to say a campaign issue, but does who she picks become a political issue in some way? Does it become a controversy at the Capitol in some way? Or does it, she makes her pick and then we all sort of move on, Marcus?
I think it's more likely that she makes her pick and we move on. One, the general electorate, frankly, could care less. I hate to break it to everybody, but, and two, by the time that happens, we're going into legislative session and everybody's hair is going to be on fire with whatever the issue of the day is, water, education, ESAs. Budget. So it's too easy to get distracted.
Okay. Matt, do you agree with Marcus?
I absolutely agree with that. I don't think the general election is going to be moved by this. Now, does the opposition try to make hay out of it, remind people about it later on? Maybe, but I don't think it's that consequential in terms of political optics long term.
All right. Fair enough. Matt Grodzki, Marcus Dellartino, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the marshmallow candy Peeps became a Christmas tradition between two brothers. But first, there's a new art exhibition opening in Phoenix tomorrow, and it's all about hair. Black hair, to be specific. Naps, Head Wraps, and Afros features black artists as well as hairstylists working together across mediums to create a fusion of art, 3D hair installations, even a live hair show performance. It was curated by Claudia June, who came into our studios recently to talk with my co-host Lauren Gilger, alongside artist and hairstylist Hope Cheyenne. Here's their conversation.
I want to start with you, June, and just talk a little bit about curating this and deciding to make it happen. What's the inspiration behind this exhibition?
Yes. So I have been a curator for about 2 years now. This will be my second Black art exhibition to this scale. The idea really came from my base community that I've been curating called For the Kinfolk. And underneath my community, I have always imagined me curating different type of events. So I started with the Black Art Socials because I wanted to be straightforward with the things that I was trying to provide for the community. I wanted to provide unity. I wanted to provide good vibes and good energy. I've always been an artist as well. And then me being a person who I'm very like thematic, so I'm always putting themes on every single thing. I call myself the country creative. So Naps, Hair Wraps, and Afros is just an idea that I had as an ode to like everybody who needs to feel this and like to see this. It's kind of just like putting our experiences in one room for one night for all of us to see.
So yeah. there's a level of like community to this.
Yes.
But you're also doing this interesting commentary on black hair and what that means, exactly. Combining it with artists, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. Each exhibition that I plan to do, like my first one was titled Give Flowers to the Ones Who Blessed the Whole Place. So I chose artists who had art that catered to that theme. And so for this time, Naps, Hair Wraps, and Afros, I chose 13 artists. 13 black local artists, most of them are local. Only person who is not, she's flying down from Wisconsin, which is like super exciting. Mm-hmm. But everybody in this exhibition has a piece that ties into the depiction of, you know, their own experience with black hair.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. So let's turn to you then, Hope, and talk a little bit about your role in this, because you're doing what's mm-hmm. called a 3D hair installation.
Yes, ma'am.
What does this look like?
This is going to be a braid, a jumbo braid, and there's going to be beads attached to them, and I made multiple of them. So there's 11 in total, and the braid is about 5 foot long. Yeah, and I don't even know what, like, maybe 7 inches wide.
Wow.
And then the beads are, I didn't even take the measurements on them, maybe like 6 inches.
Huge. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's like you ever see like a little black girl with beads in her hair?
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to bring to life, like how we used to wear our hair as kids. I wanted to be very nostalgic and just like that's where it all started. We may be having the lace fronts, you know, the long braids and everything mm-hmm. now, the knotless braids, but it started with the beads in our hair mm-hmm. and just being loud and cute and colorful. So yeah. That's what I want this exhibit to bring to life, or this installation rather.
Mm-hmm. An installation. Mm-hmm. Will it be attached to anyone's head?
No, it will not. It's going to be hanging from the ceiling, actually.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So when you walk in, you know, your eyes will look at the ceiling like, wow, yes. That's amazing.
But that will have like a real cultural meaning to
yes.
people who come to this, I'm
yeah.
guessing. They'll know what that reference is.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about what hair means to you. You've been doing hair for a long time, it sounds like. You went
yeah.
through high school doing an
yeah.
EVIT program for cosmetology, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've been doing hair for 8 years. Went to EVIT when I was 16 and 17, but I don't know, my family, they grew up doing hair.
Mm-hmm.
My grandpa was a hairstylist. He had his own hair salon. And I didn't even really know that until, like, I started doing it. So I think it's just something that has kind of always just been in me. But I don't know, to me, hair is just, it's just a way to express yourself, you know? And I feel like right now, yes, I'm expressing myself through hair, but it's bound to change, you know, as I continue on as an artist. Like, right now, that is my medium,
mm-hmm.
is with doing hair. But I think, like, for me, what's most important is always just to be able to express. So even if it's not going to be hair in 20 years, it's going to be something else. But as a black woman, our hair is so versatile. And whatever I can try to do with hair to amplify that versatility, I'm going to do it. So mm-hmm. it's like I like to look at things that are just everyday items or whatever. And, okay, how can this be hair?
Yes.
You know?
How can this be hair?
Yeah.
What does an editorial hairstyle mean to you?
Just something that's kind of out the box, you know? Like, not the everyday type of look that you would see. Also very, like, artistic. I think that it should be, when you're doing editorial hairstyle, okay, yes, you know you're working with hair. You want it to kind of fit the person's head. But at the same time, it should be, like, a direct extension of, like, who you are as an artist. And just, like, pushing that boundary.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is to me, pushing the boundaries of what traditional hairstyling looks like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, June, let's talk about how an installation like that fits into the show in general. Who mm-hmm. else can we expect to see? What kinds of things can you expect to see?
So, the first time you walk into this exhibition, you will see that installation would kind of just yell in your face. I really love Hope's installation because, like she said, it's the embodiment of us as little girls. And so when you see like a life-size version of that, it's like boom, like a memory back in your face. So alongside Hope's floating exhibition, you will see other hair installations, but are more like sculptures. And then I have a variety of painters and photographers who will be having big prints. And also I'll have an artist who will be bringing physical pieces, which is also another 3D braiding piece where an artist had made dresses out of braids and, you know, hair and things like that. So you can see some things like that, some things that will really touch people.
Yeah. So I want to end with that thought, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're trying to touch people as art does, right?
Yes.
But doing it through hair, and black hair in particular, is so interesting because there's such a storied and kind of fraught history to black hair, especially for black women, which you kind of mentioned. Yeah. Is it for you, June, about reclaiming? Is it about freedom? What does it mean to you?
I think that it's about knowing the history. And I think that it's about knowing why you should be proud of black hair. And then even if you're not a black woman and you want to know more, this is a time for other people to learn about it. So for me, I know as like black women, we have like a lot of different experiences with the connection with our black hair. But a lot of things stay the same. I grew up in a beauty salon. My mom's best friend, she was my hairdresser for like a long time. And I remember like just going through stages of like shaving my head, and then I want a relaxer, and then I actually hated that the barbershop was across the hallway because the cute boy in my school seen me. So, it's just really about bringing the joy and how, like, I can imagine in the room we're talking about things that we've experienced individually, but also things that we can relate on together.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Claudia June, the curator of this exhibition. Hope Cheyenne, a hairstylist and artist, joining us. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. When a sculptor makes a human form out of clay, what's going on exactly? Are they making a physical object, or is there something bigger happening? The show's Sam Dingman investigates.
When Gabriel Vinas was 5 years old, he used to stare at people.
You know, in elementary school, I have these kind of vivid memories of just looking at someone and kind of like seeing this person that's seen a lot more than I.
He and his mother had emigrated from Cuba to Miami, and Gabriel didn't speak much English yet. So instead of talking to the people he stared at, he would draw them. They didn't seem to mind.
Most of the time, if there's this kid that's drawing you, you're like, oh, okay, this is fine.
As early as elementary school, Gabriel remembers having a distinct sense that great art was something to be revered. At home, his mom would show him art books. She loved Michelangelo and Van Gogh. And as he got older, he kept staring at people, and he kept drawing them.
In high school, I would take a train that was about 30 minutes, so that became like an exercise where I'll take my sketchbook out and I'll do a portrait.
He started showing these drawings to his mom and to his teachers, and he could tell they were impressed. But more than that, Gabriel started to notice the looks on the faces of his subjects when he showed them his sketches. And he began to realize these were more than just drawings.
The portrait is this very powerful, very emotionally charged subject, where this is like an act of remembering, an act of honoring someone.
In high school, Gabriel tried to enroll in a figure painting class, but it was full. He ended up in an entry-level ceramics class.
I was not excited about that at all. I was like, oh, great, this is going to be a waste of time. Little did I know, right, what the future held in store for me. But
yeah.
I didn't want to be caught dead throwing a pot.
So he didn't. He decided to see if he could do the same thing with clay that he did with his pencil, make a human form. He tried making a head, and much to his surprise, he loved it. Before he knew it, 2.5 hours had passed.
And then I just wanted to do it all the time. When I got home, there was nothing else I wanted to do. I didn't want to turn on the video games or anything like that. I just wanted to sculpt.
He started asking classmates to model for him and making portraits of them out of clay.
If the person was comfortable enough, it was like someone I knew, I would like want to like feel the curvature of their cheek. I would kind of feel how the skin would feel on my fingers and then touch the sculpture.
If the portraits in his sketchbook felt like something more than just drawings, sculpting felt like more than just portraiture, something almost sacred.
There was this purity and familiarity. I could have my hands right on the piece, and it feels very personal, very intimate. And I felt like I was connecting more, not just with the work, but also with the person. And it just felt more like I was creating something. Like maybe you can throw in some weird God complex in there as well, where you're like you're creating something out of mud, you know, the kind of creation myths that a lot of cultures have about coming from the dirt. There might be something of that in there, but there was just something where it felt more like magic than drawing did for me. I never really painted or drew anything of note again.
After high school, Gabriel went to the College of Creative Studies in Detroit. And when he graduated, he got a job doing technical modeling at Ford. The money was good, but something was missing.
I just couldn't see myself only doing automotive stuff indefinitely, and then I'm like 65 and I have all the things, but it wasn't really what, like, I guess would feed my human need to make objects.
So at night when he got home, Gabriel would sculpt for hours. He started posting his work on Instagram, and one night he got a message from a scientist in Australia named Ryan Campbell. Campbell was studying biological anthropology, and he was fascinated by Gabriel's work with human forms. They started talking, and their conversations led to an experiment. If Gabriel could use clay to sculpt lifelike recreations of human beings, could he do the same with human ancestors? Campbell started sending Gabriel molds of ancient biological specimens, like the Tong Child, the fossilized skull of an early biped some 3 million years old. As he began working with these molds, Gabriel thought back to those early revelations from his sketchbook days. And it occurred to him that making a sculpture of the Tong Child was an opportunity to present this fossil as something more than a scientific relic.
Almost elevating their status as not just these specimens to be prodded and analyzed coldly, but just this like act of remembrance that this was someone's child.
As Gabriel began his collaboration with Campbell, he also started reading the works of Richard Dawkins and Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
And they talked about the scientific worldview as more than just like this cold thing. It's more like this, like, could be like a spiritual thing where there's like this poetry of reality where we are connected by the story of biology. And then that really captured my interest, because what I was trying to do before was kind of capture this little moment of connection between me and this total stranger.
What if, Gabriel began to wonder, sculpture could make these ancient beings seem less strange?
That connection that I had years ago on trains and buses, I'm trying to recapture this with this unknowable person from millennia ago. It almost like we don't get as excited as like your evangelical Christian would get excited about, you know, the ecstasy of Saint Teresa, right? Something that Bernini, like this kind of grandiose art object. I was starting to ask the question, like, if this is true, that we are all biologically related and we have this sea of ancient beings that are either related to us or tangentially related to us, why don't we hold them in such an esteem so as to make objects of reverence?
Eventually, Gabriel realized he couldn't stay at Ford. So he left, and he got his MFA at ASU. And not long ago, he got a commission to build a sculpture at a medieval church in Italy. He decided to make his own twist on the Pietà, the classic marble religious sculpture showing Jesus laying in Mary's arms. Gabriel's version is also cast in marble, but the figures are apes with their faces veiled. From a distance, it looks similar to the original. It's only when you get up close that you can make out the ape's facial features under the sculpted fabric. While he was working on it, a woman who worked at the hotel where he was staying started coming by the studio to watch him. They didn't talk much. She didn't speak English, and Gabriel didn't really speak Italian. He suspected she was Catholic, and at first he was worried that she would be offended by the sculpture. But as he studied the look on her face, he realized she was actually moved by it.
Even though it's not like the way that she views the world, she understands that I'm trying to connect.
The woman came by twice a week to check on Gabriel's progress. When he finished it, he gave her a miniature version of the sculpture, which she keeps in the hotel lobby.
We're all little enigmas to each other. We're all little, like, mysteries doing the portrait of someone in clay. You're kind of trying to chip away and trying to capture something. You're always going to miss something, but you're still making an attempt to make contact with either the world or the person that's in front of you. And that's what I want to do with this work.
Gabriel Vinas is a sculptor and professor of three-dimensional design at ASU. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
This week, the storytelling show Barflies held its annual holiday show in Phoenix. Readers tackled the theme Eating Christmas, and over the next few days, we'll share some of their tales from the table. First up is Anwar Newton with a story of brotherhood and a particular brand of candy.
I don't know how well-versed you all are on the Easter marshmallow candy Peeps. Cool. Did you know that Peeps are made year-round? Yeah, there's Halloween Peeps and red, white, and blue patriotic Peeps for Independence Day. They make green Peeps for St. Patrick's Day and heart-shaped Peeps for Valentine's Day. On New Year's Eve, they even make a 400-pound marshmallow Peep that drops to bring in the new year every year in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Peeps for every holiday occasion. I hate Peeps. But I didn't always. I used to dabble in Peeps when the mood fancied me. I once made the mistake of having a craving for Peeps and telling my brother and his wife that, quote, I could really go for some Peeps right now. And so that Christmas, as a fun joke, he and his wife got me Peeps. Boxes of them, dozens of Peeps in various colors, gingerbread man-shaped Peeps and candy cane-shaped Peeps, all for me. That year, I couldn't have laughed harder at getting them. I was honestly just happy to get to spend Christmas with my big bro and his family. I remember every Christmas spent with my older brother when I was a wee lad. He was 13 years my senior, so when he turned 18 and went to college, I was still just about 5 years old. He was kind of a big deal. First of my mother's children to graduate college, the Naval Academy at that. He played football, the Navy star running back, so getting to spend Christmas Day at the house was rare for him. After he graduated, he moved to another state, so even fewer Christmases were spent at the house. When he did get to visit Christmas, he'd often bring the newest video games he'd bought that my mother could never afford. And then Christmas was spent ignoring him and burrowing our heads into those games we never got to own. But now as an adult, for the first time in my life at the age of 24, I lived near my big brother, this champion of the family and his wife and three kids. And this Christmas, Peeps were hilarious. Then came next Christmas. Guess what I got for Christmas that year? That's right, Peeps. The Peeps in their boxes now laughing at me. Emerald green Christmas tree-shaped marshmallows lined in their box like a row of festive middle fingers. I gave a forced smile to my brother and his wife as I folded one of the Peeps into my mouth to show my appreciation. Then the next Christmas, more Peeps. And the next Christmas, more Peeps. And every Christmas after that, for the next 10 years, it became a Christmas tradition spent with my big brother that I got Peeps as my Christmas gift. The joke became mandatory with him and his wife. I never had the stomach to tell him I actually hated them. I would just secretly trash them after sacrificially choking one down with a smile. Can't break tradition. Some years I hoped he would just give me the money he'd set aside for several boxes of Peeps every Christmas. There was definitely a cell phone bill's worth of Peeps sitting under that tree any given year. Anything but the Peeps, you know? But this is what I always wanted as a kid, to be at my brother's house for Christmas. And sure, it was a little different than I pictured when I was young, but I didn't take these Christmases share with him for granted. My brother and his family eventually uprooted and moved across the country after 10 years of spending Christmas together. And I hate to admit it, but that Christmas, I had a craving for Peeps.
That That was Phoenix comic and storyteller Anwar Newton. You can hear this essay again at kjzz.org. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.